Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. I guess today's producer, composer, and music technologist, Rob Arbatier. But first, let's talk about the fact that the major labels own a bit of Spotify. I don't know if you're aware, but part of the deal that allowed Spotify to launch in the United States was the fact that the major labels got about 10% of Spotify. Now, of course, what they're hoping for is in the long run, should Spotify sell to someone, they'll make a big score. And of course, that will go to their bottom line and it won't go to the artists, or at least not much of it will go to the artists, which is a big drag. But there's more to the story than that. Just this past week, 19 Recording, which is the record label arm of American Idol, sued Sony Music. And the reason why is that Sony Music and the other two major labels have a side deal with Spotify. And that side deal is the fact that they get a block of free advertising time on the free tier. Now, that's all well and good, but the fact of the matter is that's not accounted to any of the artists or any of the subsidiary labels or any of the labels that have a distribution deal like 19 Recording. So 19 Recording came back and said, we want a piece of that because essentially you're making money and that's money that would normally go to royalties. So our royalties should be higher. So therefore you should give us higher royalties. And Sony came back and they said, wait a second, our business model is not to satisfy artists and is not to satisfy subsidiary labels or labels we have deals with. What we're supposed to do is make money for our shareholders. Now, that's all well and good, and it's absolutely true, but it's pretty harsh when you think about it. The fact that everybody else is sort of a pawn to Sony and to the other major labels as well in this game of online music distribution. There's a whole lot of intrigue going on. There's a lot that's happening when it comes to Spotify and Apple Music and Pandora and all the other online streaming and download services. And it's pretty much, does the artist get what they think they should be getting? Is the artist getting a fair shake or not? Usually, that's not the case. Now, in the case of downloads, for instance, artists only get a royalty rate, which is somewhere around 20%, depending on the deal, of a download payment. There are some legacy artists that have struck up deals for 50%, saying, in fact, this is a licensing deal, and licensing means that we should get 50%. Like other licensing deals, it's not a normal record deal. Well, the major labels caught on to that soon enough, and now all record agreements basically say a download is paid the same amount as if you bought a CD or bought the vinyl, for better or for worse. And of course, when it comes to online streaming, there's all sorts of inequities for the artists. So for instance, what the artist is actually making is only a small percentage of what the record label is actually taking in from streaming. So there's a lot more money being made than the artists are seeing. But that's not new, is it? That's pretty much been the way it's been forever. And from the beginning of musical time, artists have made most of their money out on the road. Now, it's easier if you're at the star level than if you're just starting out, but that's usually where everybody makes their money and they don't make it from recorded music. So anyway, keep on watching to see the results of 19 Recording versus Sony Music and to see how that eventually pans out. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyownercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. Go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Next thing I want to talk about is headphone mixes. I've been tracking for the last couple of weeks, and every time I go back to track, I relearn the importance of headphone mixes. In the old days, and I'm going to talk about classic engineers here and the group of engineers that I kind of learned from, they treated headphone mixes exactly the same as the mix in the control room. They spent a lot of time getting the headphones just right. Now, of course, in those days, you only had one or two headphone mixes, so it was more important. But most engineers at that point in time went out and made sure every headphone was really working. And not only working, it sounded great. And this is something that you see less and less, with engineers paying less attention to the headphone mixes. Basically, there are four things that you should really look at when you're setting up headphone mixes. The first thing is make sure you test every headphone. That means every single one, go out and listen to it, and don't listen to it just with voice. Make sure you listen to hear what happens when you play music through it, because music can tell you things that just a voice does not. So make sure every single headphone is working and really sounds good. The second thing is make sure there's plenty of cable. You should have extension cables for each headphone because musicians like to move around. And also, you want to keep those headphones working, and the best way is have plenty of cable. The third thing is make sure there are no intermittents in the headphones. There's nothing worse than having your headphones work perfectly, and then you move your head and suddenly they don't work, or they're cutting in and out, and that will distract a musician worse than anything. And the fourth thing is make sure you dial up a mix for the musician. And this is really important because many musicians are great players, but they're not necessarily good at getting their own headphone mix. Now, in the old days, we didn't have to worry about that because essentially the headphone mixes came from the control room and you paid attention to them, so they're pretty good. Now, the way it works is they all have boxes that they can control their own mix, which is good and bad. It's good if you know what you want, but it's bad if you don't. And many, many musicians that I've seen in the studio either don't know how to work the headphone boxes, so they can't get a good mix up, or they're just not good at getting mixes up. So the best thing is to go around to each station and dial up a mix and start from there and then educate the player as to how to change it to their tastes. Now, many of the new headphone boxes and some of the cheaper ones actually work in a better way in that the player is listening to a stereo mix and then has the ability to add more or less of him or herself. So it's what's known as a more me mix. And that's pretty good and it's pretty easy and just about everybody can get the hang of that. But a lot of headphone boxes are not set up that way. So the point here is, pay attention to your headphone mix because you're going to get really happy players, and happy players play a whole lot better. My guest today is one of my compadres on the Audio Nowcast, Rob Arbatier. Rob is a composer, keyboardist, technologist, and he's worked closely with Stevie Wonder for 30 years. Rob's Noisy Neighbors production company has also done dozens of commercials, movie trailers, and albums. Rob also has the largest collection of music gear that I've ever seen, and that's hardware and software. I spoke with Rob from Philadelphia via Skype. Rob, thanks for being with me today. This is great. Wanted to have you on for a long time. Thanks for being with me.
I am really happy to be here. I've been looking forward to this.
I love to hear stories about people that started in the music business and became successful from the standpoint that it shows their tenaciousness. And your story about how you got with Stevie is the perfect illustration of that. Can you just go through that a little bit? Because I think it's one of the coolest stories I've ever heard about getting in the music business, and especially with a high-level artist.
Well, I'm happy to tell the story. I'll say right ahead of time, you know, I have people ask me for advice on how to get into the business. And other than being tenacious, I don't know that there's much to learn about how to get into the business from my story, because it was a pretty unique situation. And but I'm happy to tell you the story.
Sure.
How it all. So when I was a teenager and into my, I guess, very early 20s, like 20, 21, I used to be a summer camp counselor in a suburb of Philadelphia at a place called Abington Friends. And I used to teach music sometimes and photography. It was actually more photography, and it was the early days of computers. This is like the early 80s, so it's a long time ago. And the music teacher, one of the other music teachers there during the summer camp, liked to write songs. And so I would write songs with her. And her name was Frommy Cohen, and she's a very gifted songwriter who went on to write a lot of children's musicals and plays and things. So Frommy and I used to write songs together in the summer just for something to do. And during the school year, she was a teacher. And I think she taught fifth grade, maybe. And after camp ended one year, she played some of our songs for her class just so they could hear songs she had written. And one of the kids raised his hand and said, "You should play these songs for my dad because he knows Stevie Wonder." And Frommy was like, "Okay, I can play these songs for your dad." And I was a huge Stevie fan. So Frommy called me and said, "Look, this kid wants me to play songs for his dad who knows Stevie Wonder. Will you come to the meeting? I think as much as anything, it was like for security, because it was weird, you know, being called into the meeting was going to be in a lawyer's office in downtown Philly. And it all just seemed very weird. And we weren't writing songs to try to get them placed or anything. We were just having fun. I mean, I was like, 19, 20 years old. So we went to the meeting with this kid's father, and this kid's father ended up being the manager of a band called Mix, M-Y-X, which was a pretty cool band, sort of an Earth, Wind & Fire kind of band. They were looking for a keyboard player, and they were looking for songs, and Stevie was going to be supposedly producing their album. And so I really wanted to meet these guys because it all just seemed really exciting. So that meeting took place on May 13th, 1985. And I remember that for a few reasons. One, because it was a pretty pivotal day in my life. But also, it was the day that MOVE headquarters in West Philadelphia got bombed by the police, and half the city was on fire.
Yeah.
And I remember driving home from this meeting watching Philadelphia burn behind me. So I remember that. And it also turned out to be Stevie's birthday. It was Stevie's 35th birthday. And Stevie wasn't at this meeting. It just was a coincidence. So all these dates, you know, everything came together on this one date, May 13th, 1985. And I met with this kid's father, and he liked the songs we had written. But I found out that this band Mix was missing a keyboard player. Their keyboard player had left to go on tour with Sister Sledge. And at the time, I was going to Drexel University for engineering. And I was not audio engineering, just like computer engineering and electrical engineering. And I'd always been a music head. I'd studied classical piano since I was three. I'd taken jazz lessons since I was about 12 or 13 as well. Stevie was my complete hero and musical idol. And so I was not having a lot of fun at college. So I thought, I just have to find a way in to this band Mix. And I started cutting class and going to rehearsals with this band. And I slowly realized, even though I'd never even thought of being in the music business, this is really fun. I found myself in a recording studio called The Warehouse on Delaware Avenue in Philadelphia.
I remember The Warehouse.
With Lance Quinn and Obie O'Brien running it.
I remember them.
And, you know, that was my first studio experience ever. And we were just the band that was going to be produced by Stevie Wonder. And all of a sudden, I'm this dorky white kid going to Drexel University for engineering. And now I'm in like this funky, amazing band that's going to be produced by Stevie Wonder, who's my hero. So this all just seemed too good to be true, and often things that seem that way are. But it was pretty exciting at the time. I was spending less and less time at school, more and more time with the band and recording at The Warehouse. So eventually, Stevie finally called for the band. Oh, no, actually, before that, I had never met Stevie Wonder up until this point, and the band said, okay, we're going to introduce you to Stevie. What I didn't realize is Stevie had sort of been letting the band sit on the shelf for a while just because he was busy with a lot of other things. And the band saw me as a technology guy as a way to sort of reinvigorate Stevie's interest in the band. And the main reason they thought that, and I actually told this story at the Yamaha booth at NAMM this year in their synth museum. The reason the band thought that is I had a DX1, which was a very rare keyboard. The band didn't realize I had it basically borrowed from a music store. I hadn't actually bought it because it cost like 12 grand and I had 12 cents to my name. So, but a music store named Cintioli Music here in Philly, Benny Cintioli, the owner, believed in me. He thought I was a good kid and he lent me this synthesizer to see if I could figure out how to use it and then I could report back to him. And so I had this DX1. The Mix band got very excited that I had a DX1. The only other person they ever saw who had one was Stevie. And they thought, we're going to bring Rob into this band because he's going to get Stevie to be excited about us again. So everybody had their little hidden agendas here. I just wanted to not be in school and meet Stevie Wonder. That's all I cared about. I was 21 years old, and that's all I cared about. So we ended up crashing a party that Stevie was having where he was playing Part-Time Lover for his friends for the first time. And it was in Alpine, New Jersey, and we showed up. We thought we were invited to the party. Our manager, George Carey, who was a crazy guy, but he made a lot of things happen for us in his crazy way. We basically pulled up at Stevie's front gate in Alpine, New Jersey, and George said, okay, Mix is here. The band is here for the party. And Stevie's security was like, we didn't invite you guys. You guys aren't here. But George was a good talker, and he did know Stevie. And George talked us into the party and said, look, we drove all the way up from Philly. You know, this is outside of New York in Alpine, New Jersey. We drove all the way up from Philly. You got to let us into the party. So eventually we got into the party. And I'll never forget, I walk in the front door of Stevie's house in Alpine, New Jersey, where years later I would spend tons of time. But this was his big debut party for Part-Time Lover. And I walk in the front door, and standing right at the front door are Eddie Murphy, Joe Piscopo, and George Benson.
Wow.
Just standing around.
Yeah.
And so I'm flipping out. I'd never even seen a famous person before. So I'm freaking out. We go in the party, and it's this beautiful house, and there's a million people there, and there's music playing throughout the house. And the band says, we got to find Stevie. We got to introduce you to Stevie. And apparently they'd already told him about me, but I had never met him. So we go into the room where Stevie is playing DJ, and he's playing his new album for this crowd at his house. And we waited till between songs, and the band pulled me up to him and said, okay, we're going to introduce you to him. So they got me up close to Stevie and said, hey, Steve, this is that kid, Rob Arbatier, we've been telling you about. We want you to meet him. And I'll never forget this. Stevie, I was standing on Stevie's left, and he reached out his right hand to shake my hand because he didn't know where I was. And I flipped out because I thought, oh, my God, he doesn't know where I am. I don't want to embarrass him. He wants to shake my hand, and I'm standing on the wrong side. So I just about killed myself to run around the crowd of people who were standing next to him so I could shake his hand where he was holding it out. Now, if I'd known then what I know now, I would have said, yo, I'm over here. Yeah. Shake my hand over, you know. But I didn't know him at all. And so this was my first chance to shake his hand. And he said, it's nice to meet you. And he smiled. And I was just freaked out because he was my number one musical hero since I was like 2 years old. And I've always kidded him about this. He had his first number one hit a month before I was born.
Wow.
So he's basically been in my life for my entire life. So I met him at the party. I was freaking out. I ran into the kitchen and called my parents. It was like 3 a.m. to say, I finally met him. And that was it. My future was sealed. And I said, okay, I'm coming to California to work with this guy. I don't know where it's going to lead, but I joined Mix as a formal member. I left Drexel on what is still considered a temporary basis. I still have a little card to re-enroll if it ever comes to that. And then in October of 85, I made my way west with the band. And to fast forward through things, we worked with Stevie a little bit as a band. I got to know him a little tiny bit, but then he left on a huge U.S. tour in 86 to support In Square Circle album and Part-Time Lover as a single. And we had worked with him for a few months, and things were great. We worked on a Neil Diamond record with him. That was actually the first record I ever appeared on, was a Neil Diamond record. And that was fun, and working with Neil Diamond was fun. But then Stevie left to go on this tour, which was going to be like 6 or 7 months. And we just found ourselves sitting in LA basically with nothing to do. So I thought, okay, this has been fun for a few months. I finally got to meet my idol, but I can't just sit around here. I had my own software company on the East Coast that I've been doing things with. I already had some things going on, even though it was pretty early in my career. Nothing musical, but a lot of technology stuff going on. And I said, I need to get in with Stevie in a way where he's not just going to leave me on the shelf month after month like he's going to with this band. So the band started to fragment a little bit, as any band is going to do if they're just sitting around for 6 months with nothing to do. So what I did is I decided, you know what, I need to find an in with Stevie. And he knows I'm a musician, but he has every musician on earth wanting to work with him. So that's not a very unique position. And he has players who are, I'm sure, way better than me and a lot cooler than me and everything else. But the thing that Stevie doesn't have is he doesn't have anyone writing software for him. And software is something I knew how to do. And I thought, you know what? I need to create for him the first music software specifically tailored for blind people, because I know no one else has ever done it for him. This is the very early days of music software. I said, I think that's going to be my hook. That's going to be what makes him pay attention to me, because I'm never going to get his attention as a piano player. I mean, he has Herbie Hancock. He has anybody he wants as a piano player.
Yeah.
So what I did is I started maxing out my credit cards, and I bought him, at the time, what was a cutting-edge compact portable computer, which to call it portable was hilarious. It was basically a giant computer with a handle on it.
Yeah, they were huge.
Oh, they were huge. And I decided I'm going to write him his first MIDI sequencer. The only other MIDI sequencer I'd ever seen at the time was one called the Roland MPS system, which was terrible. It was as basically functional as something can be and still be called functional. I mean, it was just horrible, horrible software. And there was no way to make it non-visual either. It had these horrible little graphic blocks on the screen when you were recording. It was terrible. You can look it up in the history books if you ever want to see what it looked like. But I thought, okay, I can buy a Roland MPU-401, which was the only MIDI interface in those days, and an IBM PC, and I'm just going to write him some non-visual software. So I wrote him a sequencer, which I called S, which stood for sequencer. And it was an 8-track sequencer that was very, very basic. I mean, play, stop, rewind, record, fast forward, and that was about it. And it was 8 tracks of MIDI, and it was written in uncompiled BASIC and a little bit of assembly language, so the timing wasn't even great, but it was functional. And what I did, as I was running out of money and my credit cards were getting maxed out, I decided it's now or never. And the band mix had already sort of not fallen apart for good, but everybody had been doing their own thing because we've been sitting around for months. So I decided, okay, it's now or never. I'm either going to make this play with Stevie or I'm going to give up and go back to Drexel and go back home to Philly, having had my fun in LA. I decided, okay, I'm going to go for it. This is where the tenacious part, I guess, comes in. I booked myself. I found out where Stevie was going to be on tour, which was at Radio City Music Hall. Oh, no, Madison Square Garden in New York is where he was doing his In Square Circle tour. And I found out he was staying at the Plaza. And these things were a lot easier to find out back then before 9/11. You know, the security was nowhere near what it is these days. So I found out where he was going to be staying, and I booked myself a ticket to New York from LA. And I figured, okay, if this doesn't work out, I can always just return to Philly after this, but I have to make my big play with Stevie. So I flew to New York, and I went to the Plaza, and I asked the bellman, you know, which room is Stevie Wonder in? And they told me, gives you an idea how long ago this was.
Amazing.
And I just camped out on the hallway floor outside of his room. And I got there at like 9 or 10 at night, and he was still, you know, on stage at Madison Square Garden. So I ended up falling asleep on the floor of the hallway with this compact computer in my little bag, you know, the clothes and stuff that I had. And I just camped out there, and Stevie ended up coming back to the room, and he and his whole entourage started walking up the hallway at about 3 a.m. And then I started freaking out again because I hadn't actually seen him in months. You know, he'd been away on tour. And when they got to the door, they're looking at me, you know, his bodyguards are looking at me like, who are you?
Yeah, yeah.
And I said to him, hey, Steve, I'm Rob, that guy who's in the band Mix. You know, I met you. We worked together a few months ago. And he remembered basically who I was. And I said, look, I have something here that I think you're going to really, really like. And I need you to check it out tonight, because if you do like it, I need you to buy it from me because I'm completely broke and I have no way to get on past tomorrow. And if you don't like it, then I'm giving up on the music business and moving back in with my parents in Philly and going back to school. So either way, this is a make or break night for me. And I think it's something you're really going to like, though. So I think you should check it out. So he's like, okay, this kid's crazy. Come on in. Let's check it out. And I ended up showing him this terrible sequencer I had written called S. And I showed him how he could record, you know, 8 tracks of MIDI into it and play it back and punch in, fast forward and rewind. And he was completely taken by it. And we ended up staying up all night playing with it. And then he did end up buying the system from me. But he also then said, well, you just got to continue with me on the road here. You know, we got to keep playing with this. And so he would do his shows. I was not involved with his shows, but he would do his shows. And he ended up getting me either a room in his suite at each hotel in each city, or he'd get me my own room. And then at night, I would actually sit and work on the software and make whatever changes he wanted. So he was loving that. He had never had a software engineer just traveling around with him writing software on demand. And I was loving it because here I'm getting to hang out with Stevie Wonder, and in a way that I have zero competition. There is no one else on earth vying for this job.
Yeah.
And so as time went on, I ended up building S from a horrible sequencer into just a terrible sequencer. So that was an improvement. And I ended up traveling with him, and I ended up slowly getting more and more involved with the shows. And his technical director at the time was a guy named Bob Brailove, who ended up going to work for the Grateful Dead at the end of that tour. So during that tour, I was sort of being groomed as a possible replacement for Bob. And by the end of that tour, which was a few months later, I ended up being Stevie's technical director and was basically running the show for the live shows. So within the span of that one tour, I went from introducing him to the software to being fully integrated into his whole live thing. And then, so by the end of that tour, I was the technical director. I don't remember what the title officially was, but that's what it was. I was basically the only technical guy overseeing things. And then it was just a logical transition once we got back to LA to start working with him in the studio. And he gave me full access to all of his toys. So he put me in a room with a Synclavier he had just bought and said, figure it out.
Wow.
You know, it's really cool. Learn how to use it. And there was a manual, a stack of manuals about 12 feet wide, which
I remember those.
And so that's how I transitioned from the road to the studio. And a few weeks ago was my 30-year anniversary with Stevie. So it all worked out, and it was just a natural progression. And obviously I moved on into the 90s. I moved on to a lot of other things besides working with him, but I've never stopped being involved with him. I'm actually working on another set of blind software for him right now. We've come a long way since the days of S. I mean, now it's all non-visual layers that I designed that run on top of Pro Tools and Cubase. And we've gotten very, very sophisticated, and he can now record an unlimited number of MIDI and audio tracks, but still using a lot of the same principles that I came up with for him in 85, because he loved that workflow. So one of the reasons we don't use other commercially available software for the blind is we had developed a workflow that just felt completely natural for him and still does. So I keep coming back to the basics that we figured out all those years ago, even for the newest stuff we're doing.
I didn't realize that you continued to develop that with him. But I got to tell you, what's interesting, and one of the cooler parts of the story is the fact that you were completely honest with him about what was going to happen that night. Either he buys it, or else you quit the business, you go home. And you know, again, if you're going to get someone's attention, that would be the way to do it. Be really direct rather than beating around the bush.
Well, I was completely broke, and my credit cards were completely maxed out. And I'd spent, I think, that compact computer, by the time I did all the memory upgrades and everything else, it was like $8,000 or $9,000.
Wow.
You know, so I was completely tapped out. And also, it's not like I was that much in the music business that it was going to care if I left. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'd only ever played with this band from Philly, and I'd only ever worked with him in the studio a few times in LA, but it's not like I was firmly ensconced in the music business. I still thought I could go back to Drexel, be a computer engineer, you know, and follow that whole path, which probably would have led me to NASA eventually. All my friends from back in those days who were on the same path as me ended up, most of them are dealing with NASA and space stuff now, which is really cool. And I would have been perfectly happy doing that. So it was a bold thing for me to be able to say, you're going to drive me out of the music business if we don't do this. But I wasn't really in it. But Stevie, I've learned, he always appreciated that direct approach. There were always a bunch of yes people around, you know, like any big artist would have. And I was always more direct because I had no choice. I mean, I was at a place in my life, I was young enough that I really hadn't figured out a career path yet. I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up. So I definitely didn't know back then. So I had the freedom to be direct because there was like no consequence.
Do you have a favorite Stevie story?
A favorite Stevie story? Well, I'd have to say probably my favorite moment is for my 40th birthday. We threw a big party at my house in LA and my whole family came out. I had about 150 family and friends at the party, and Stevie came to the party and ended up playing and singing me happy birthday and like doing a little set there in the house with everybody from my childhood friends. I mean, a lot of people flew out for this party. It was a big deal. So childhood friends were there all the way up to my 90-year-old grandmother. And I still have firmly emblazoned in my memory Stevie, and we had sort of a stage set up in the corner of the room, and he was performing, and some other bands I was producing were performing too. But just him singing happy birthday and saying some really nice things about me to my entire set of friends and family was a pretty magical thing. I mean, I've had amazing, many, many amazing memories. I mean, I saw Stevie in concert just a few weeks ago in Austin, and he started the show by talking about me and the family for the first few minutes. You know, we have a really, really tight connection. And when my parents passed away, he was, you know, very upset about that and did a lot of really nice things in regards to that. He's really become a member of the family. And so I have many, many, many happy, amazing memories with him. And it's funny, most of the ones I come back to are not the ones that are professional. I mean, playing with him in Brunei was an incredible experience, but it's more about the personal stuff. You know, the messages that he left when my father died and stuff he had left me voicemail messages, which I've saved and then spoken with him about. I mean, it was just incredibly touching, real, amazing stuff.
That's really awesome, though, because that doesn't happen that often where, you know, many times it's just an employee relationship rather than part of the family.
No, as the decades ticked by, it definitely became a family thing. And I mean, I was close to his mom. He was close to my mom. And that's actually what he was talking about in Austin at the show a few weeks ago. You know, he acknowledged that I was there and talked about the family. And he said that, you know, I had lost my mom. And that reminds him of when he lost his mom. And, you know, we've always had this very tight personal connection. And, you know, it started out, it didn't start out that way, obviously. It starts out as employee and employer, but.
Yeah, but the fact that you were working with them intimately, I'm sure that made a big difference because, and intimately for so long, you know, long periods of time. And again, as you say, with no competition, that had to make a difference in your relationship.
It definitely did. And it was for a long time. I mean, we were spending 24/7 together because I'd always be in the hotel room next to him. We'd sit next to each other on the flight because this is another funny thing. You know, these portable computers back then, they were portable, but they weren't battery operated.
Yeah.
At least not in the beginning. And so I used to get onto airplanes with him. It's funny, when I would travel with him, people always assumed I was his manager or his lawyer or something because I definitely didn't look like his keyboard player. But we'd get on a plane and I would have this heavy compact computer, and then over one shoulder I would have a lawnmower extension cord, like a 50-foot extension cord, which I could unroll down the aisle of the plane and plug it into the shaver outlet in the bathroom to run this computer.
Wow.
Which he could get away with because he's Stevie Wonder.
Yeah.
And then as time went on, I would carry the lawnmower cable. And then I also had this giant, like a small car battery or a big motorcycle battery or something that had a transformer on it, a sealed lead acid battery that we used to carry to the plane for power. Can you imagine trying to get on an airplane now with a giant lead acid battery?
Yeah, that wouldn't happen, would it?
Would not happen. But that's how we used to travel. So I was literally with him 24/7 if we were traveling, if we were in hotels, whatever. And so, yeah, we built a strong bond.
But later on, you got into doing your own thing with doing movie trailers and commercials and things like that. How did that happen then? Did that just kind of happen naturally? Was Stevie a connection there that helped that go on? Or what? How did that come about?
Well, in the early days with him, I did some commercials with him. We did some commercials for Hanson Soda. And we did some commercials for some Japanese companies. And I sort of got the bug that, well, commercials are kind of fun. And the refreshing thing about commercials is they're quick. You know, each Stevie Wonder album was taking years to do because there's so much detail and so much material. And you record so much more than you release. And so a Stevie Wonder project for an album would be 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. You know, it could go on for a long time. But these commercials that we would occasionally do with him were quick. You know, it had to be in and out in a few days. And I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, that's the kind of project you can squeeze in the middle of other projects. And I got to know Gary Olazabal was Stevie's engineer and co-producer back then. Later changed his name to Gary Adante, which is another whole story. But I got to know Gary O working for Stevie. And we did a lot of album work together, starting with Characters, I guess, which came out in 87. Which is my first album with Stevie, although I did some of the remixes for In Square Circle, for Overjoyed, and a few other things. But I got to know Gary really well working on the Characters album. And Stevie used to leave us alone for long periods of time. And so we started to work. We'd work on his stuff together, but then in our spare time, we'd work on our own things. And it sort of occurred to us, we could maybe squeeze in some commercials because they're very quick, and maybe we could just get into the commercial music business as sort of a sideline thing to do when Stevie's not around, because he would travel sometimes. One of my favorite traveling stories of Stevie, by the way, I don't know if I've ever told you this story, but Gary and I were working on something for one of his albums, and we were at the studio at Wonderland working, and Stevie was in his office on the phone or something, and we were working on it, and we'd spent hours and hours, and we were getting it close to the point where we were ready to play him something. You know, we've been trying to come up with some drum sound or something. And so Stevie came into the big room where we were working and said, look, guys, I need to make a run. I'll be right back. And so we said, okay, we'll just keep working. So we keep working, and hours and hours and hours go by. Stevie doesn't come back. Finally, his driver comes back and walks in the room, and we say, well, is Steve with you? We have something. We were ready to play, and we were ready hours ago. And his driver looked at us and said, oh, I just dropped him off at the airport. He's on a flight to Africa. And he didn't come back for months. So that's when we realized, you know what, we got some spare time on our hands. And so that is actually the moment when we decided, you know what, we're not just going to sit around for months doing nothing. And Gary and I started going after commercial clients. In the beginning, we were just doing it for free because you got to get your, you know, your toes wet somehow, and you got to get your chops together. So I had a lot of recording equipment at my house. I was always a gear freak the same way Stevie was. So that's another reason we hit it off, because we were so into technology. But I had a studio at home, and Gary started coming over, and we started working on commercial stuff. And that's what ended up forming into Noisy Neighbors Productions, which did – we started by doing a lot of commercials. And actually, Noisy Neighbors, we just – oh, no, next week is our 25th anniversary.
Wow.
Yeah, it was that long ago. And our first – we did a bunch of commercials for free. Then we got a few paying gigs. But our first actual jingle we did that saw the light of day ended up becoming famous or infamous, however you look at it. And that was for Hot Pockets.
Really?
Hot Pockets.
Yeah, really? That was yours?
I wrote that in 1991.
Wow.
And they were supposed to use it for 13 weeks. And they're still using it. But yeah, so I wrote that infamous jingle that Jim Gaffigan, the comedian, then did a whole hilarious set around. And it's kind of become this legendary, ridiculous jingle. But yeah, that's one of the first jingles I ever wrote.
Wow.
So that's my first claim to fame in the commercial world. But it was cool to hear it on TV all the time. I mean, it wasn't cool that it was a buyout and that, you know.
Yeah, right.
By now, if it had not been a buyout, by now it would have been millions of dollars. Of course, if it had not been a buyout, I would not have gotten the gig. So, live and learn.
When you do commercials, what's the – you just said the best thing about that was how fast they are. But what's the worst thing?
The worst thing is that they basically – they're usually produced by committee, and they generally will suck the creativity out of most of it because there's so many people who have to approve things. I did not enjoy the approval process. I did not enjoy how much more it was about the business than the creativity of it. It's funny, when Hot Pockets started, it was actually going to be this smooth jazz thing, and we were going to get in a combo to really play it, and it was going to be this whole other thing. And then by the time the ad people, you know, there's so much riding on it for a company like that, that everybody feels like it's the most important thing in the world, and everybody's got to take a stab at controlling it. And, you know, it's hard to argue with. I don't know if you know this, but Hot Pockets, the brand, which largely people associate with the jingle, as well as the nasty food, but the Hot Pockets brand ended up selling to Nestle in, I think it was 2004. Correct me if the facts are wrong here, but I believe the brand sold for something like $4 billion.
Oh, wow.
And so they built it from this little nasty microwave truck stop food into this brand. It was the patent that Chef America, who created Hot Pockets, a lot of it was the patent they had for the little metal sleeve that you could put in your microwave so that it would cook crispy instead of soggy.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that patent was worth a lot. But yeah, Hot Pockets ended up being worth billions of dollars.
Hey, it would have been good if they paid you in stock, huh?
Yes, that would have been pretty good. No, I mean, we got pennies, and the singer, very talented singer named Jennifer Sihe, I remember at first we hired her because it was supposed to be this sort of jazzy Hot Pockets kind of thing. And then by the end, they just wanted more energy, more energy, more energy. So then she's screaming Hot Pockets, you know, like the top of her lungs, she's going hoarse, but they finally loved it. Yes, they will love this in America. This is going to be huge. But she ended up being able to go after them later saying, look, you guys were supposed to use this for 13 weeks. This is a very good lesson, by the way, for anybody looking to get into this game. You never know what little gig like that you might do that seems like a little nothing that could turn into something huge. I mean, realistically, it would have been, I'm told, somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 million [S2] Wow. [S1] By now for someone to have used a jingle like that for 23, 24 years. And that's conservative, you know, and that jingle became a household name. I mean, people know about it.
Absolutely.
So there was some real value there, and you know, live and learn. You know, I wouldn't have gotten the gig if I had fought too hard, you know, for the money. But it's a good life lesson for people out there. You hear plenty of stories of successful people getting screwed in their early days for reasons just like this. And the trick is learn from it and grow.
Well, you don't seem like you have a grudge, so that's the good part about it.
No, I mean, you know, I don't think of it as a good jingle. It's really terrible and cheesy, but it's famous and it's hilarious. And it's the kind of thing that is always a conversation starter. And it's just a funny thing I'm glad I did a million years ago.
You know, I had the same experience. Well, not exactly the same, but with Suits, the first time I did a jingle and five guys in suits came in. I was just shocked. It was so out of place for a recording studio in the 70s, you know, to have these guys in suits come in and sit there. And then you know, there's always the alpha male that has, you know, a lot to say, and the other guys sit there and not say much until they do. And then when they do, then everything gets crazy, and usually it's contradictory from what, you know, somebody else is saying. So yeah, I had, you know, many times the same experience.
Yeah, that's my least favorite.
Yeah. It wasn't fun for me either. It wasn't something that, and I had one experience that, I was filling in for a guy in the media house once, you know, for a couple of weeks engineering. And this is in the days, it was in the '80s. So it was in the days before you had, really high quality landlines and you had ISDN and all that stuff. So this was being recorded in Seattle via satellite, but the ad agency was in Las Vegas. So the agency was on the phone listening, and it was a Scope commercial, and the actor that they used was Spock's father, you know, on Star Trek, the guy that plays Spock's dad.
Yeah.
So he was doing the voiceover. So the satellite time was really expensive, so you had exactly 15 minutes, and it had to start and stop in exactly 15 minutes. And I remember that they did a voiceover, and he said, well, can you edit something? Oh, yeah, I'll edit it. So it was on tape, and I edited something. Oh, we don't like that. Can you put it back the way it was? And I couldn't find the tape that I cut
out. Oh, man.
And it fell on the floor, of course, behind the machine. And the agency, who can't see me, is on the phone. They're going, what's happening over there? What's going on? What's going on? Because there's dead silence. So that was a, you know, a little pressure pack, to say the least.
Oh yeah, and I mean those moments make you stronger, but oof, they're not fun when you're in the middle of them. I've had my share.
You know, one of the things that you were talking about being a gearhead, and you are by far the biggest gearhead I know, at least from the standpoint of you have more gear that you've never gotten rid of and it could fill a warehouse. So I know what Stevie has. Well, I've heard what Stevie has, but in many ways you're comparable. What's your favorite gear, your favorite piece of gear all time?
Well, it obviously changes over time as new things come out. And it's one of the things I've enjoyed about being in different parts of the industry. You know, we went from commercials into movie trailers, and we went from that into some more post-production based work and working in surround. And every different part of the industry that I would move into presented new toys. And so I'd always be exploring new toys and new ways to work as just an excuse to buy more gear. And that has worked out well for me. I guess for me, there's always sort of two different ways I look at the gear. There's the gear that I think musically helps me be more creative. So whenever a new instrument comes out, you know, that I find like an inspirational thing, because there's a whole new sound palette. And so over time, there have been many instruments that have come out that I thought were really inspirational. Actually, the first one from my earliest days with Stevie was the Waveframe sampler.
Oh yeah.
It's a very unique musical instrument that I basically, I bought one and I financed it for 10 years. My parents helped me get a loan, and I was able to buy it in my early days, but it did 24-bit sampling in 1986. So it was way ahead of its time and is still probably the best sounding sampler ever made for pitch shifting. You could take a bird chirping and drop it 12 octaves and turn it into an earthquake with no artifacts.
Wow.
It's just an amazing sounding sampler. And that's how I met Scott Gershon, actually, the big sound designer, because he was into it too, because you could do such amazing otherworldly sounds that you couldn't do with any other device. So through that device, I actually met a community of people, many of whom are my friends today. Mm-hmm. So that was a very important instrument for me in the early days, both socially and musically and everything wise. So as the years have gone on, there have been a few pieces that have come and gone. That was probably the first piece that had that kind of an impact. The Korg Oasis more recently, you know, was an example of that, like a workstation that could just do everything I needed all in one box. And I found it very inspirational. But I mean, I've been through, well, you've seen, I've been through hundreds of synths and different sound creation tools over the years. And I've had different favorites at different times. I'd have to say in my entire career, even though I don't use it anymore, the Waveframe has to win because it had such an impact on my life. And then there are other things like the D-Control. I have a 48 fader D-Control, which I absolutely love. It's like an extension of me. And when I'm mixing for post, more than music, but when I'm mixing for anything, it's just my favorite video game in the world. You know, I sit in front of that thing and it's just like an extension of me, and I find it a very creatively inspirational tool. So I'd have to say that ranks up there.
But you know,
it's funny because it's just
what's different with you is, though, is you never get rid of gear, where other people will buy and, you know, they'll buy and sell it, they'll trade, they'll do whatever, and you just, you know, hang on to it. And I'm just curious, how often do you go back, like in your back room there with all, and software as well, you keep all the software versions. How often do you ever go back and say, oh, yeah, okay, I can use this, or let's pull this out?
Well, the vintage hardware I definitely go back to. As a matter of fact, while I was, I just flew on a red eye last night, and so my brain had a chance to wander, and it actually occurred to me, I haven't pulled out the Dynacord drums in a while. You know, I'm going to pull out the Dynacord drum module next time I'm back there, just because I remember those cheese ball sounds. I want to hear what those sound like again, and I'm going to work them into something modern. So the hardware I go back to all the time. I don't get nostalgic for vintage software and vintage bugs.
Yeah.
So, you know, once a new version comes out, you know, I just upgraded a bunch of my machines to having Native Instruments Complete 10. I'm not going to long for the days of Complete 9. It's just never going to happen. So, you know, but I definitely have some hardware, especially that I go back to because there's still no software that approximates it. Even going back to, you know, the Roland Super Jupiter and the, you know, the really early Korg stuff and the early Oberheim and Moog stuff that I have, there's software that gets close, but even if the software can sound similar, it's not the same as the experience of grabbing the knobs and dials and in real time coming up with the sound. You know, I have a Mini Moog Voyager in the studio that has memory and everything else. I find I don't use the memory on it much. I like grabbing the dials and just coming up with a sound. I mean, I'll save it in case I have to come back to it later for fixes. I learned that in the commercial world, you need to be able to come back to something even 10, 15, 20 years later and make changes because things never die. But I like the creativity of grabbing the knob and adjusting the sound in real time. And I still use, like, the Schwaemann S1 was a very rare analog synth that I have, which has no memory at all. But it's not that there isn't software that kind of that doesn't sound kind of like it, but there's something about grabbing the controls. That's as much a part of the sound as the sound generator itself. The creativity that it inspires in you is just as important as the sound generators itself.
Yeah, yeah.
So I do go back to the archives.
I know what you mean. There's just something about an analog instrument. Well, not necessarily an analog instrument, but the interface that you get, the hardware interface that you just can't.
Well, sure, like the D control, there's nothing analog about it. It's just a whole bunch of knobs, but there's something about the way that they're laid up and the way that user interface ties in with Pro Tools. It's just such a tight fit and a fast workflow. And I mean, I'm excited about the S6 and later stuff from Avid too, but you know, there's familiarity with the tool you've been using for years. And honestly, my clients don't care what gear I have. They care what I do with it. So, you know, it occurred to me, well, do I scrap the D control and switch it for an S6? And well, you're right. I probably won't do that. I will probably keep the D control and put an S6 in a different room because the D control I have just this flow with that I'm sure I'll have a different flow with the S6, but it'll be different.
Yeah.
And when something's working, I'm not eager to give it up. It's one of the reasons I still have so many of the old synths. I can still sit down with like some of my early Dave Smith stuff and dial in a sound and know, hear it in my head and then have it come out of my fingers. It takes a long time to sort of build that familiarity with a piece of gear or software. And I don't like to let that go that easy. You know, just because a tool is new doesn't mean it's better. So I'm always working in new stuff, but loath to get rid of the old stuff.
I mean, one of the drags now, the good part is there's so much new that comes out all the time, and that's great because sometimes it's new boundaries that are being broken. But the problem that I find is the learning curve many times. And it's not just one learning curve. It's the fact that there's multiple learning curves going on at the same time many times. And you know, that's kind of a drag. It's like, I just like to sit down and have this work rather than having to learn how it works before I can do it, you know?
Well, and one of the balances I'm always finding now is when something new comes out, I'm always trying to figure out, how new is this? Like, is this really revolutionary or is this just a slight difference? And the question always comes down to, is this worth the time it's going to take to learn it?
Yeah.
You know, and if you think about it that way, is something worth the time? Forget about the money for a second, which is still an issue, but is this worth the time it's going to take to learn it? And is it going to be worth it to stop doing things the way I used to do to now do things this new way? Those are always the things I'm thinking about, because time is precious, and you never know how much benefit this new gear is going to bring to you. So I definitely don't acquire gear at the rate I used to, because I pretty much have everything in the sound palette I'd want to create covered. You know, if something new comes out, like a good example is Native Instruments Machine, you know, a couple years ago came out. And, you know, it came with some new sounds and stuff, but I thought, you know what, this workflow is a little bit crazy. It's very different than the way I'm used to using the virtual instruments in Cubase, Pro Tools, and occasionally Logic and other things. This machine stuff is kind of crazy, but I see the work that people are doing with it, and I see how this could be cool. So I actually went on a little expedition and spent a few days just trying to master machine. And the truth is, it was worth the journey. Even though I'm using the same sound libraries that I already had, it has me using them in a new way. So that was an example of, it's not an expensive tool, but it took a bunch of time to really master it. But it was worth it. And so I'm always balancing now whether something falls into that category or is it just new for the sake of being new.
Where do you see...
Go ahead. There's only a few times each year that I see something that I think is worth that much effort anymore. Even with all the zillions of new things at the NAMM show, there's a lot of, you know, version 8 of something that version 7 was okay for. You know, there's a lot of just minor improvements, not too many revolutions.
There's not many people that are qualified to answer this, but you're one of them, in my opinion. Where do you see music, hardware, and software going? For quite a while now, we haven't had a revolution. We keep on seeing evolutionary products, and we haven't seen a revolution. Do you see something on the horizon?
I'll tell you, to me, it seems like a pendulum that swings back and forth between the hardware and software. And at the last NAMM show and with the things I see going on now, it's swinging back more towards hardware. And I don't know if it's because the software is a very level playing field now. Like, everybody can have every sound they've ever imagined. And to be successful in the music business or the post business, you have to have something unique. So just using the same tools as everybody else is not going to give you a leg up. Now, you may be that talented that you can use them that much better than everybody else, and that's good. But for the most part, in the old days, everybody had a very different arsenal of tricks and sounds. It's one of the reasons you could spend $400,000 for a Synclavier, because it might get you some sounds that no one else on earth could have without one. Yeah. That is done. You know, that's not there anymore. Everybody can have a laptop loaded up with every sound you could ever imagine. So hardware, though, is it's always more, I don't know what the right word is, not unique, but I don't know. Hardware is not going to be as widely, evenly spread out as software. It's more of a money commitment. It's a little more of a space commitment. So the people who get hardware arsenals are always going to have a little bit of a leg up because they have more unique stuff. It's one of the reasons I keep so much hardware around. I still have toys that make sounds that no software can make, and that gives me a leg up because I can come up with sounds that other people can't come up with. But I see, like, I was just exploring the new, I don't know how new it is, but the control keyboard from Native Instruments that lets you control the complete software. That kind of hardware tied with software, it's the same thing machine was, for me when I first discovered it. That, to me, is a perfect blend of hardware and software that's affordable. But if you get the hardware, it lets you bring the software to a new level. Mm. But you didn't hear, like at NAMM shows 5-6 years ago, you didn't hear anybody talking about hardware like that. It had swung completely to software. It had swung completely to iPads. I mean, for a while, you'd go to the NAMM show and you'd think it was the iPad show. You know, everything was an app. And that's fine, except when everybody has an app that costs pennies, then everybody's going to have it. So where's your uniqueness as an artist?
Yeah, there's no money for developers either. So that's kind of a problem.
Yeah, that's a problem too. But seeing all of the little synths from Arturia and so many companies had interesting hardware synths. Dave Smith, you know, now having the Sequential Circuits name back, and Moog still doing great stuff, and so many great synths out there, and a lot of the analog modular systems out there. I see a generation getting excited about that stuff, sort of the way the next generation is sort of excited about vinyl records. You know, it's exciting because it's new to them. The difference between now and the old days is it's way more affordable. People don't realize you'd go to a Guitar Center or something and a synth was $5,000 for a single synth, you know, and people got used to spending those numbers. And if you were in the stratosphere with the Sinclavers and the Waveframes and the Fairlights, it was dozens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. The hardware has gotten more affordable with the complete or the control keyboards, you know, being under $1,000, even for the big one. And with all of this new hardware that has sort of a software component, I think the pendulum is swinging back and people are going to realize, you know what? The hardware is what gives me the interface to the software. The hardware lets me take the software to another level, because it's been a while since I've heard a revolution in the software.
Yeah, you know, that's for sure.
Everybody keeps coming out with bigger libraries and more of the same with a little more variety and maybe more voices and stuff. But the basic sounds you get, you know, if you think about what makes it to your completed song or your completed film, people don't care about how many voices your synth had at that moment. They care, does this sound unique? Is it a unique composition? Does it sound interesting? And the hardware gives you much better control over the software to do something unique. So I like that it swung back for hardware, although, again, I'm running out of physical space. So I like it when the hardware's not too gigantic.
Yeah, you have a bit of a problem there.
I do. Have you noticed that same sort of trend? Did you get that sense at NAMM?
Yeah, absolutely. And you could definitely see it switching back. And again, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that it's tougher to be a developer, a software developer, because the return isn't what it was, or it wasn't what everybody thought it was going to be. So this last NAMM, there were fewer startups that I saw in general, software startups, and you saw a lot more hardware around. Like, you know, Dave Smith, for instance, he had a bigger booth. There's new stuff coming out. Moog had, you know, a big thing, and actually, you know, reissuing the old modulars and stuff like that. So there's definitely a taste out there for that stuff. I agree with you.
And it's gotten, and the thing that's amazing about this generation of it is how affordable it is.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the little keyboards that Arturia had, and I mean, I love the Dave Smith stuff, don't get me wrong, but the price point of, like where Native Instruments is doing with their keyboard controller, it's really affordable for the masses.
Yeah.
And that's an exciting thing. Because the hardware, in the old days, hardware always meant really, really expensive. I don't know how these companies are making stuff so cheap. I mean, the machine interface with its beautiful displays and the multicolor LED pads and everything, I mean, it's beautiful. It's the kind of thing that, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you could have said it was $10,000 and people would have said, yeah, I can understand that.
Thank you, China.
And there was, yeah, I guess so. But it's impressive because 10, 15 years ago, you couldn't have even done something like that for $10,000, you know, and now it's a few hundred. It's, I don't know. I love it. I find it exciting. Also, I've been traveling a lot more, working in different cities, and the hardware has gotten really portable. I mean, I just landed this morning, and in my carry-on luggage, I have a Native Instruments machine. I've got 3 MacBook Pros and an iPad, all set up with Pro Tools and Cubase and a bunch of sound libraries. I've got an Apogee interface and a Universal Audio interface and a little MIDI keyboard. with it, all in carry-on luggage. I mean, the idea of that kind of a production powerhouse being portable, unthinkable a few years ago.
Well, you're a little bit beyond most people with that, with three laptops and two interfaces and whatever. But nonetheless, what you say is true. The fact of the matter is you can carry it with you. You can take it where you go.
That amount of horsepower a few years ago was unimaginable to be portable, just not even possible.
There's so much more I want to talk to you about, and we could go on for a long time, but I don't want to keep you more because I promised that I would keep this, within reason anyway. So one last question. What's the best piece of business advice, music business advice, that you learned in your time in the business or maybe someone imparted to you?
Probably the biggest single piece of advice is know your value. Understand your value and your worth even from the beginning. Like, I've told the story of how I started with Stevie, and what I was doing back then had real value, and he appreciated that value, and I didn't really appreciate that value. And without going into too many details about the business between him and me and how we worked all that stuff out as years went on and everything else. But understand, even if you're just starting out, that if you have something unique, and it's not just about technology, it could be about musical creativity or post-production sound design or your ability to mix or your ability to write lyrics or whatever. Understand that even on your first day of doing it, you have some real value. The Hot Pockets is another good example. Sure, we did it for no money and we were just starting out, but we were creating a sound signature for a brand that was going to launch that brand into a multi-billion dollar company. I had no sense of that back then. I clearly understand now what we were doing and how they were kind of taking advantage of us, although they were a small company at the time too. But understand your value. Don't be so quick to do things for a buyout. You may be helping to build a brand that's going to be worth a lot of money down the road. In the case with Stevie, I was creating something for him that was going to revolutionize his way of working and thinking. And it's not that he didn't appreciate it, because he did, but I don't think I appreciated what a major thing it was. I was just so focused on, I got to get to meet my musical hero.
Yeah.
So understand that even if you're doing things that you feel lucky to be doing and that you feel like are benefiting you, understand that you're benefiting whoever the other party is too. Don't sell yourself short, even from the very beginning.
That's great advice. Rob, thanks so much for being with me today. This is awesome.
Awesome. Well, we have plenty more to talk about. We'll do this again. But I appreciate you cutting it off now because it's been a long day.
To find out more about Rob and Noisy Neighbors, go to noisyneighbors.com. That's noisyneighbors1word.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com, and he helps put the show together. Thank you kindly, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.